All of the Fretboard Journal podcasts are brought to you by a few presenting sponsors. First up is Marden Guitars. Marden Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Then we have Carter Vintage Guitars over in Nashville, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Also, Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And we have a brand new presenting sponsor, Calton Cases. Your custom instrument deserves a custom case. Thank you to all of our presenting sponsors. Hey everybody, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, founder of the Fretboard Journal magazine, and as always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. And this, believe it or not, is our 300th episode of the Fretboard Journal podcast. This has been quite a journey. It's been, what, a decade of podcasting? We have covered all sorts of ground. We've interviewed so many people, and we've had so much fun with this format. Thank you all for tuning in. Thank you for listening. Thank you for checking out the other podcasts that have sprouted because of this podcast from us. The Truth About Vintage Amps, the Luthier on Luthier podcast. I think we have one or two other podcasts that we're going to be launching fairly soon. Again, I can't thank you all enough. Some of you have provided us with subjects. Some of you have provided us with feedback. And some of you have just sent encouraging words that have kept this thing going all these years. And it's been a truly special thing. Speaking of special, it's our 300th episode. I was trying to figure out what to do. I contemplated doing a best of episode featuring some of the best snippets from our first 300 or first 299 episodes. But what I ended up doing for this episode is finally letting air a very cool conversation that happened just a month or two ago between three friends, myself, the amazing Bill Frizzell, and the amazing Anthony Wilson. This was a Zoom call that happened. I was chatting with Bill, texting with Bill, and he said, maybe we should talk to Anthony. And so we scheduled a Zoom call. I recorded it. These two guys are the coolest, as you know already, but it was so much fun to just talk to them, kind of be a fly on the wall. I let them do most of the talking. Nobody wants to hear me. But it was a great conversation. Not a lot of gear talk. We talked about other things. We talked about inspiration. We talked about books. We talked about the fun stuff that makes people tick and how we're all doing during this process, during this crazy year. And I hope you enjoy it. Anthony has a great record out called Songs and Photographs that everybody should check out if you haven't yet. Anthony's got all sorts of projects, but that's his most recent album, and I encourage everybody to go check it out. It's on Bandcamp as well as all the usual places. And Bill, who puts out a great record every year, released a truly great, great record this year, 2020, called Valentine. It's his second album on Blue Note. And if you are like me and feeling a little pensive and feeling a little worried about the state of affairs, just go on over to wherever you listen to music. Listen to Bill's interpretation of what the world needs now on repeat for an hour or two. I've done it. It feels good. And then dive into the rest of that record because it is so good. And thank you, Bill, for putting out that record this year. We all needed it. Before I get to this very fun and very cool chat, I got to give a shout out to our sponsors. First up, Mono. Monocreators.com is where you can read up on their entire lineup of gig bags, studio monitor stands, pedal boards, pedal board bags, everything they do. Is so ergonomic, so well built. I just talked to Adam Miller, a week ago? And he was talking about all the stuff he was able to cram into his mono bag. And pretty much every musician that comes here, if they don't have a flight case that weighs 800 pounds, has a mono gig bag. And so trust me when I say their stuff is incredible and is extremely well built and built to last and to be comfortable. Go to monocreators.com. Tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Our other sponsor is our friends over at Retrofret Vintage Guitars in New York City. Every time I go to their site, it's like going into a museum where everything is for sale. Right now, for whatever reason, I was gravitating towards all the Chicago-made cool instruments that are on their new arrivals page. A 1919 Lyon and Healy-style B mandolin, one of the great if not, in my personal opinion, I know everybody wants an F5, but those Lion and Healy mandolins are just incredible. Stella H922 12 string from 1967, a 1930 SS Stewart Model A4000 flat top, and a coolest of all, probably a 1966 Harmony H22 electric bass. I know someone out there probably has a Stratotone. Get the matching bass from retrofret.com and tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. And then our last sponsor is our friends over at Isotope, isotope.com. They create noise reduction software that plugs into whatever you're already using to edit audio. And if you are at home, maybe doing home recordings, or maybe you've started a podcast, you will undoubtedly encounter some weird sounds that were not intended to be in your final recording. It happens to me on a weekly basis, thanks to all the podcasts that we do. Isotope has this incredible software that plugs into what you're already doing and is 10 times smarter than the built-in stuff that came with the software you're using. So check it out. We're actually able to offer a 10% discount on Isotope products if you go to isotope.com/ruinous and then use the code RUIN10. And I'll include a link to that in the show notes, but we love our Isotope products around here and we're very glad to have them on as a sponsor. 300 episodes of this podcast. Like I said, a couple of other podcasts have sprung from it, Luthier on Luthier, as well as the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast. Go check those out if you haven't yet. And our 46th issue of the Fretboard Journal, it's our 15th anniversary year. It's our 15th anniversary issue. It is available now. It is mailing to everyone around the world. So if you've already been a subscriber, if you already are wondering, hey, when's the next Fretboard Journal showing up? It's going to show up in the next 2 weeks, depending on your mail service, maybe 3 weeks, depending on if you live like on the other end of the planet. Roseanne Cash and John Leventhal are in that issue. Finally got to interview them. A big piece on Mark O'Connor and his return to flat top guitar and that Martin that he bought at George Groom's when he was just a teenager. Christopher Paul Stelling's in this issue. An incredible tribute to Hubert Sumlin, on and on. We packed so much into this issue, and we're going to pack so much into every issue in this, our 15th year. A lot of features and interviews that are literally years in the making are finally going to see the light of day, and it's going to be a fun one. So if you haven't joined us yet, I hope you will. Go to fretboardjournal.com, click on the subscribe tab. We are a reader-supported magazine, which means that we don't feel or look like any other guitar magazine out there. When you hold a Fretboard Journal, it weighs more than a pound, and there's barely any advertising. And all the advertising's at the front and the back, and you've got like 110 pages there in the middle with not a single ad, just feature after feature after feature. And we're able to do that because of subscribers who have decided to support us. And it's a different business model than pretty much any guitar media company around today. And because of you, we've been able to do it for 15 years. So I hope you will subscribe if you haven't yet. We also have digital subscriptions now where you just get the PDF instantaneously. If you subscribe now, you'll get issue 46 in your inbox within seconds. And that's a great way to support us no matter where in the world you are, because it's $30 no matter where you are. And you get the magazine, but you're also just helping us out with the podcasts and the videos and all the online content that we offer for free. That's all I got to say. It's been 300 episodes. Thank you all for the feedback. Thank you for the inspiration. Thank you for all the great ideas. So many of our podcast guests have come to us because somebody emailed me and said, hey, you really should go interview my neighbor. He is so-and-so. Or have you thought about this guy? He just made me the greatest guitar I've ever had. So keep those coming. Podcast@fretboardjournal.com is where you can email us. And with that, I will now share with you this incredible and fun and super informal conversation I had with the great Bill Frisell and the great Anthony Wilson, and I hope you enjoy it, and we will keep conversations like this and other conversations coming, hopefully for another 300 episodes of this podcast.
Oh, it's good to see you. Good to see you.
What do you guys want to do besides chat? Yeah.
Anthony, like, we hardly, you know, you're somebody I wanted to spend more time with.
Yeah, same
like
here.
Play and yeah. And there's so many thinking, you know, we have so many folks in common that we have we have played with, or, and then I've got all these questions, you know, like, I think you might be a, I was taught, well, actually, Jason had a hand in hooking me up to meet Dennis Budimir and
right.
Bob Bain. And
right.
And then I was thinking, wow,
you guys all got together down here in Southern California years ago.
It was like, when I think back, yeah, it's like the weird, it's like having like a dream, really like some, it does seem like a dream now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was just curious with you and thinking about your dad. And then I know, and then I was checking out this Chico Hamilton record. I think it's from like 61. It's very either.
The Gongs one?
Yeah.
Yes.
And then I saw your dad had done a lot of stuff on
that. Very late 50s, yeah.
Like that period of Dennis and see, my mind starts racing because there's so many things we could talk about.
Totally.
But that, like the guitar players that came through Chico Hamilton's band and Dennis really affected when I first heard him, discovered him in the, I guess it was around 1970 or something. My teacher, Dale Bruning in Denver, turned me on to some of those records that you're talking about with Keltner.
Yeah.
And here I go with the connections again, you know. He was playing with Gary Peacock and Keltner and
Vincent.
Albert Stinson, and then it starts getting into Charles, who we both played with.
Yeah, totally, totally. All these connections.
So I don't know. I'm not a. Do you know some of these people?
Well, you know, I mean, for me, I definitely have met Dennis many times over the years, but also not really gotten close to him. You know, a lot of my encounters with a lot of these guys came through being close to Pisano, to John Pisano.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he's another one of the in that. Yeah.
Yeah, just because, you know, I got to know John, I don't know, maybe even as early as around 1998 or 99, and started hanging out with him and playing at his guitar nights.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so through those, you know, you'd have Bob Bain playing on a night, or you'd have Dennis, for example, different people. Mitch Holder would come through, so various folks that I think you've encountered here, and so they're kind of part of the community. So it's not that I got more close, I'd say, to John Pisano than anybody. I mean, he's almost like a father figure to me. But
wow,
I mean, every time I see Dennis, it's like very warm. I used to live close to Glendale, and we'd shop at the same Whole Foods market. So I'd always see him
at
Whole Foods. And he's super into working out. So he'd be in his like workout clothes, and we'd be at the checkout counter, and we'd talk about music. And my father, because he played in my father's band towards the end of the 60s, my father really liked him. And of course, that Chico Hamilton record that my dad wrote a couple of songs for. So they knew each other for many, many years. And my dad, my dad would say, you know, Anthony, you should go study with Dennis, you know, Budimir, he's amazing, you know. But I never, ever got a lesson from him. But so cool. Yeah. So
And then that was so out. You sent me that. I Feel Good, the James Brown song that your dad did and Dennis is playing. That is wow.
It's really great. He's got like a super twangy sound, and it's you know, he's sort of the central exposition of the melody, and he's playing those sharp nine chords. It's hilarious. Yeah. It's great, you know, beautiful. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, this, I guess, quite a community here in Southern California over so many years, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and the history of guitar playing, I don't know, it's kind of wild thinking. I mean, just thinking about Chico Hamilton's band, like Jim Hall and Dennis Budimir and John Pisano, Gabor Szabo, Larry Coryell was in there, John Abercrombie was in there later, you know.
Unbelievable. All that music is so, so good. I have a friend who lives in Portland. He's a winemaker.
His
name is Scott Frank. He has a winery called Bow and Arrow, and he's a huge music guy. He also has a bar. He and his wife have a bar in Portland called Bar Norman, and they play a lot of vinyl, and he's like a DJ guy, and he's super into interesting music. And we had this conversation recently because we both had conversations with other people who didn't quite take Gabor Szabo seriously. And so we were like, he had that experience. And I was like, that's so weird, because I had that experience too, where somebody was like, could you explain to me the deal with Gabor Szabo? And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, it's so amazing. So we're putting together we call it Gabor College, a big playlist. To convert people, because like those records with Chico are amazing.
Oh yeah.
And Paul, and it's also incredible.
Yeah, and him with, that was another thing skipping around, but Gabor and Charles Lloyd together, like that Of Course album.
Yep.
And then, you know, since then they've released some other stuff. But for me, that was, to hear the guitar in that context with Ron Carter and Tony Williams and Charles Lloyd, I mean, I'm sorry, but that, you know, that's like a, oh, I don't know what you call it for me, but you know, that's one of those touchstone things.
Yeah. You know. Same. It's so freewheeling, so free spirited, so open, so energetic. There's just so much going on, and it's taking off from a place and going somewhere else, you know.
Yeah. And he had that way. Well, the dialogue, I guess, or the conversation that he would have with Charles all the time, it was never about, and there was that space, even being the only harmonic instrument, and what he did with so few I'm saying these same things over and over again, but with a minimal amount of notes, he could get a maximum amount of impact and subversion, or you know, it was so. And then the tone, and that, you know, playing a Martin guitar with flat wound strings, whoever did that? Well, John McLaughlin did too, so I don't know.
Wow, it's so incredible. Those sounds are just amazing to me. It's perfect. And then, I've been listening to that record, Passing Through. Oh, God. It's a really long tune, Lady Gabor, that I love so much. It's that interplay that you're talking about, and that kind of composition freely together, that polyphonic thing just interweaving so beautifully.
Yeah.
When's the playlist going to be done?
Well, my friend is like, let's just go forever. So it's about an hour and a half long, I'd say now. So probably when it gets to be a couple of 3 hours, we'll make it public.
Well, let me know.
Maybe we should get serious on it now, you know, get super serious now that we're talking about it.
I want to see that too.
Yeah. Yeah. And Keltner, you know, on Gabor's albums.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he's on this Dennis Boudemir album.
Yeah.
That I've been listening to lately, this session with Albert, with Foster. And it sounds like they just got together at the house.
Oh. Yeah, I think it was recorded. There's one of them you can hear. There's one, there's a dog barking and stuff. Their phone rings and stuff.
Yeah, false start, and then, yeah, super long tracks, but it's great, you know.
Yeah, Albert Stinson and Keltner to get, man, and it's swinging so hard, and yeah.
And, you know, that's a kind of a weird little thing, because it's Revelation Records. And I don't know who the guy was I think there are two owners, but one of the guys who owned it, who wrote the notes on that particular one, turned out to be a guy who wrote notes for some of my dad's albums in the 60s on Pacific Jazz.
Oh, wow.
John William Hardy, who I'm not really, I'd have to do a little research to find out really who he was.
Oh, what
he was
doing. Yeah.
He definitely wrote a few of the liner notes for my dad. So he must have been here in LA on the scene.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, there's a few of those, maybe even four or five of those with Dennis. And
yeah, I've only ever found one. I need to keep digging here. But you've got them?
I have a bunch of, I think I might even have, I might have, I'm not sure if I have all of them, but there's one that's just, it's just him. I think like he's overdubbing with himself. Dennis is just playing. And then, yeah, there's one with Gary Peacock playing. I mean, we think, wow, the folks that were in LA, you know, at that time, it's.
Yes.
There's, what is it? Oh, and Bill Goodwin, drummer. So I think it's Bill Goodwin and Gary Peacock. There's like a trio.
Amazing. I didn't know that Bill Goodwin had been out here. I guess I wasn't.
Yeah.
Wow.
The Blues Sprung Free or something like that. And I got one. You know, when I met Dennis, I brought my Second Coming is another one. I brought the album and I got an autograph and everything.
Oh, he's incredible. I mean, his lines are just like oblique and moving and really interesting and singing. He also has a kind of also quite a insistent tone that I like.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's what I always felt like he was. The lines would go, they would always go like just a little bit further than what you expected or something. It was like when I first heard him, I had you know recently discovered Jim Hall and Jimmy Rainey, and that I always thought of him as like the next thing after Jimmy Rainey or something. It's sort of maybe because they were playing that, you know, those Charlie Christian guitars or whatever. I love his tone and stuff, but the lines would just keep going.
Keep going.
And then that he was playing with Eric Dolphy. A guitar player playing with unison stuff with Eric Dolphy. Wow.
It's totally.
I mean, to this day, it still seems like about as modern and ahead of its time as you can get.
Is that particular record the only one where they played together? Where was that particular group, the Gongs?
No. There's about three or four of those. There's one.
Okay.
Oh, man. the three faces of Chico.
Okay.
And there's a few that, and where they're actually playing some of Eric's tunes, you know, that you might hear late, you know, a few years later.
Yeah.
So it's so cool.
Yeah, you hear him processing bebop language and then like putting it in the computer and taking it immediately where you know where it's gonna go. And it's just it's incredible to hear that alchemy of his musical thought and genius. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
I can't believe that's like 60 years ago, you know? And it's like, to me, I don't know. It just seems so, still so new.
Yeah, completely. Completely. Yeah, I think Los Angeles was interesting at that. It's always been interesting, and it's always interesting to me, but something about that time frame is quite fascinating to me. I think there's a lot of mixture, a lot of collaboration going on. I think there was also a lot of separation too, you know, but I'm talking racially, you know. But
oh, yeah.
It was a great deal of collaboration that, like on those records, that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
And, that maybe got kind of lost after a certain point. But I don't know. I think there were interesting musicians doing interesting things at that time, kind of together, cross-pollinating that are super cool.
Yeah, it gets up. I don't know. That's what always, things are always so much more complex than, you know, West Coast cool or whatever they say, you know. Yeah. People just, okay. Yeah. That's that. They lump something all together. That's like our problem, you know, ongoing.
Yeah. I mean, because people like Harold Land is recording with Scott LaFaro, you know, like, Buddy Collette is doing really interesting projects. You have Eric Dolphy. Just a lot of really interesting.
Yeah. And Ornette, I mean.
Completely. Right. So, yeah, because like even the first album there with Ornette on Contemporary. I don't know why I'm
speaking. Oh, here. Oh,
with the piano.
Yeah.
But that's like a really interesting, you know, sort of little lens into a moment of discovery.
Yeah. Billy Higgins was on that too, right?
And yeah. Why am I spacing on the piano player?
Yeah, that's one of those. I know.
Anybody who listens to this will be like, you guys.
You think anybody will know what we're talking about?
Of course. Bill, have you ever thought of moving to LA? Did you ever?
Yeah, actually, right before when we left Seattle, we went on this trip, and it was a close call.
Really?
No, we knew we wanted to leave Seattle, and we took this drive. You know, we went all. How did we go? Like, I mean, I grew up in Denver, so we went, drove to Denver and then came back around, went through Santa Fe, and all along we were sort of fantasizing, and then we really wanted to check out LA. I'm talking about just a few years ago. And it was, and you know, we were looking around, we stopped in Joshua Tree and all that. I mean, it was amazing trip. We were thinking about it. But then New York was just calling. I don't know, some, I guess, because, you know, I lived here before, and it ended up just feeling like coming back home.
Sure.
Yeah. But man, yeah, LA gets a bad rap about, there's so many, you know, unique, one of a kind. Well, that's what I think what came on so strong when I left New York the first time. When I first lived in New York, it was like, yeah, New York, it's like, there was nothing outside of New York, you know?
Yeah.
And then just, we moved to Seattle and I started just opening my eyes, you know, a little bit. And it's like, man, there's people, as long as there's people, there's somebody's going to be doing some kind of weird thing, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've always loved that I came from here, you know, and got to live here as a native so that I could see it through the eyes of a native, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Because people tend to simplify it, as you say, and kind of put little boxes around it and define it via things that they get, information that they get or recordings or whatever, stories, narratives. And and it always transcended those things for me, you know?
And Even just the
geography and the topography of it, I find much more interesting than what a lot of people say about it. But then culturally, for certain, you know, so many different pockets of amazing art and culture and music.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the one place where, I mean, certainly if you have to commute for 2 hours to get to your job that you don't care about, you can burn out on LA. But for creative people, it seems like the one place where there's always other work to supplement. Creative types can always get jobs, it seems, from the outside in the LA area, thanks to movies and all the other industries, and they can still do their art and not be miserable. I don't know. Maybe I'm sugarcoating it, but
sure. And it's nurtured a kind of a thing that I've seen over time in musicians that seems to me to be unique because of maybe the recording aspect of things. You have all of these, and maybe it goes back to thinking about these players that we're talking about, such as Dennis or many different kind of studio guitar players who played on a lot of records, or Wrecking Crew guys, or, you know, all the way to today, to people like, you know, to people like Matt Chamberlain, to people like Blake Mills, you know, over the years, these kind of unique people who draw from a lot of different disparate elements to kind of make their music and their sound and their individual imprint. And then they give that to music. It seems because there's always been so many different things to work on, people find a way to kind of do that and then make their individual stamp on.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Recorded projects that may be unique. It's not quite the same even in New York, you know?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
Bill, before COVID, how often did you actually get to the city, or do you just stay in your house?
No, that's what's been so difficult. I mean, it was literally, you know, we're living out in fairly far out in Brooklyn, but I'm right by the, pardon me?
Where?
It's, do you know where Ditmas Park is?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, there's houses and trees and it's quiet, or it was quiet before all this whatever going on. But it's actually one of the quietest places I've been. It's quieter than in Seattle.
It's crazy.
Except for the helicopters and the sirens and lately fireworks. Like, it's like with the fireworks. But anyway, we're right by the subway, and I'd be every day, I would go somewhere.
Okay.
right into town or you know, Manhattan or other parts of Brooklyn. And now I haven't been on the subway since early March. You know, I've only really been where I can walk. So we rented a car, which was quite an adventure, and went out to Long Island last week and saw the water and all that. That was amazing. But that's there's 2 days that I haven't been right in my neighborhood.
Wow.
So that's because we don't have a car. So I think if this goes on much longer, I'm going to have to get a car. We could have done that in LA too.
Yeah.
That was one of the things I was saying, man, if we live in New York, we don't even have to have a car. Not so true now.
Are you anywhere near where they were having kind of outdoor porch concerts over the last weekend?
Oh, yeah. I just went and saw a bunch of guys. Kenny Barron was out.
Barron was playing.
Wow.
So awesome.
Noel posted some videos. We know Noel in common for years and years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I saw that he did. And, you know, I can't believe we were probably standing right next to each other, but nobody knows who anybody is. It's like a bunch of bank robbers walking around, you know?
Yeah.
See, he posted pictures of all the places where I had just been. I know if you're watching. But that was beautiful just to hear. I don't know if you know Roy Nathanson, saxophone player. He's been doing it every day, I think, at 5 o'clock, plays just one song.
That's great.
And whenever that was, the first time I went over there was the first time I'd heard actual music coming from people. It was so beautiful. Just, you know, it'd been weeks and weeks and weeks of just being in your own head all the time. And I've only played once, but my friend, that's the other Thomas Morgan bass player that I play with all the time. He lives in the neighborhood and we couldn't even, it's like, man, here we are. We're both home, you know,
it's crazy.
But he came over a little while ago and we played in the backyard.
Oh, great.
So hopefully do more of that.
Yeah, it does.
Have you been able to be with people at all?
I just did day before yesterday, one day in the studio with Gerald Clayton.
Oh, wow.
He's doing some scoring on a documentary film.
Oh, and, cool.
That's really quite interesting. It has to do with the relationship of, it has to do with civil rights movement and Martin Luther King and the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover.
Oh, wow.
Surveillance and...
Oh, wow.
Trying to entrap him, I think. So Gerald has a beautiful scoring. So we actually got to be in the studio together at a distance, you know, and everybody masks with, do you know Alan Hampton, the bass player and songwriter?
I don't think so.
He's fantastic. And really, I think you'd really love his music. He's really a wonderful songwriter and singer. But bass player, jazz bass player, and a drummer named Jonathan Pinson. So we were all together. And
And you actually played together?
We played together, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It did the heart good, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Gerald is, I'm like super fan of, I mean, I've gotten to play with him a little bit. Man, yeah,
I love him so much. Yeah. He's amazing. Processed so much. I mean, he's so sensitive, so in tune, so tuned in and present.
Yeah.
Bill, did I see a picture of you or a picture of, have you been composing like crazy? Have you been super productive?
It's just my usual, it looks, if you look at it from a distance, wow, it's like Beethoven or something, you know, but if you look closer, it's, I'm accumulating piles and piles and notebooks of, because I just keep going at it every day, and I'm not sure what all's in there yet. I haven't, that's how I usually things, it's almost like drawing or something, you know, I just keep writing whatever it is, let my ear sort of take me, and then I'll go back and sift through all of it and try to see if there's something. It took me a while to figure that out, like to not block, but we've talked about this before, you know, writing, it gives you the chance to judge. It's slow enough that it's dangerous for me to, in that moment, to judge whether it's good or bad, because I'm always going to think it's bad, and then it just stops the thing. So I finally figured out, okay, I don't care if it's good or bad. I'm just going to keep, you know, just keep pushing through and keep just write. And then figure out whether it's good or bad later.
Well, I remember there's a couple, I wanted to ask you a little bit about this too, because over observationally and watching your process and thinking about how your composition has evolved over the last couple of decades. And I remember kind of like a published book where there was some facsimile.
Oh, yeah.
Your handwritten stuff. And then I remember seeing you work with the quartet with Jenny Scheinman and Hank Roberts and Avan Kang. And you had like even just very small fragmentary pieces of paper with interchangeable lines and like with nothing fixed, and people could, it seemed that different players within the context of the performance could choose. And I wasn't always sure if you were cueing or if these things were at choice. And then I saw the little video that you posted of the notebooks, and I just thought a lot about your process. And I love this idea of fragmentary, ephemeral, capturing ideas and not going to the place of judging the idea, but just getting it out, getting it out, and then going back later and seeing where it goes, you know, and how to utilize it in performance.
Yeah, that's what I also have difficulty like committing to. Well, like that's like someone like your dad would. You know, the moment when you have to decide, well, this instrument's going to play in this register, this you orchestrated, you're going to, and you know, I'm talking about time when guys wrote every, which I still do, write it with a pencil, you know?
Yeah.
So I've gotten spoiled with the bands I surrounded myself with, like that string group you said, you know, I might have four parts written out, but that's what was so amazing about it, because they would, you know, the cello didn't always have to play the bottom. It could be, well, why don't you have the violin play the bass part and cello plays this part, and they could, and it got, you know, we know each other so well and trust each other, and it ended up being this sort of spontaneity, like the orchestration became as much a part of the improvisation, or whatever the word you use.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes, I don't know, sometimes it was obvious who should do what or whatever, but there were a lot of choices being made.
Yeah.
I think like that's with most of the folks I play with, I'm not good at giving direction. You know, I just always try to, I've said that before, you know, a band is only as good as its weakest link. So I make sure that I'm the weakest person in the band usually, and then I just let them go, you know?
Uh-huh.
That works pretty good.
That really resonates with me too. And I've, as a writer, I like that idea of being able to bring stuff and make sense of it through the relationship of playing together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anthony, how's your writing been through this last few months?
I haven't filled up a bunch of notebooks. I saw that video and I was like,
no, but it's,
oh,
I swear.
God, he's so endlessly creative, you know, and, but I've been working. But I've been working on a number of things and mostly songwriting stuff. So songs with lyrics. So I finished about 5 songs with lyrics over the past few months. And I was supposed to be for some of this time, for 3 months in the middle of COVID, be living in Memphis. I have a project that I've been working on that started off kind of just because of a curiosity about my family, my genealogy, my father's place of origin, which is the Mississippi Delta. He's from Shelby, Mississippi, which is a little south of Clarksdale, Mississippi, an hour and 20 minutes south of Memphis. So after he passed, I realized I'd never even been to where he was from. I didn't know what it was like. So I went a couple years later, and I'd always been fascinated with the culture of Mississippi, with the culture of the Delta and the blues and folk art and gospel music and prison songs and everything from there. And I hadn't been there. So I went and started photographing the first trip. Yeah. And then I, over the last few years, started going back more frequently, and I started writing music that's related to the places where my father was from and other places and people that I've been meeting along the way and stories that I've been learning, and kind of coming up with a chronicle inspired by this place.
That's crazy.
But I had to stop and I couldn't go back. And I was really depressed about that and wondered when I'd be able to go back. And so one of the things that I've done over this period was see if I could do a little research and write from the research. And I've done a couple of songs like that. So it helped me because it made me know that even without being in the middle of these places and meeting different people and gathering stories, I could still generate some work, even being here at my desk. So that
Wow. So you didn't go there till you never were there with him or anything?
No, never went with him. He hardly went back. I mean, you know, his mother lived there. She died in 1987. She's born in 1890, and she died in 1987. And she was for many decades a school teacher there. You know, she taught at the only black grammar school. You know, when he was a kid, you know, she had a little schoolhouse. And then eventually she taught in the actual school once schools became more like institutions there, but they were still segregated. They were segregated for years and years until the 60s. And then she was there and she was like a pillar of the community, but I don't think he went back to the town more than once or twice when she was still alive. I think she came out to LA. So he passed away in 2014, and in 2016 I was in Nashville playing some gigs, and I had some days off between some gigs, and I thought, let me just rent a car and go to Mississippi. That was a real, I was glad, so glad I made that decision, you know.
Amazing. Yeah, that I remember the first time I went there, it was, was in Memphis and just driving out of Memphis, and then you come into that Delta thing, and it's like, wait a second. It was like, it's so strong, you know.
It's so strong.
It's really intense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you feel it all. You feel the history. You feel the mysticism. You kind of can, you understand immediately why the music is what it is, even without really understanding. But you just go, okay, you know.
Yeah, the sun, just the whatever it is in the air, not even the temperature, it's something. I don't know what in the air there is.
Yeah, yeah. And I actually had wanted to ask you, because this thing that I'm doing, and because of over the last few years, I've had this relationship in my writing to visual material, and I've always really been fascinated about the things that you've done that are responses to visual material, either silent films or still photography, such as this Farmer project or the paintings of Gerhard Richter. I find these responses and dialogues like super interesting. I think they just make for amazing music, you know.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that, because it's almost like I think your mind, the way our brains work, it just, I remember one time I had to do some film music, and it was like I turned on the TV and I don't even remember what it was. I turned on the TV with no sound, and then I just put on some record, and it was like, it's, you know, things were hooking up like bam, bam, look, you know.
Yeah.
It was just random, but your eye and your ear sort of connects it. But I also think that whatever it is that makes you want to take a photo, right? Or what makes you want to draw a picture, or what makes you want to make a film, or it's the same thing that makes us want to make music, right? So they're already connected. They're connected already. So just,
totally.
I have trouble writing. Like if you ask me to write a sad song, again, it's the way I was described when I write, I have to just let it cut. I can't decide beforehand what it's going to be. So when I've done these things, a lot of times it's that next step after I've accumulated some stuff and try to see if something resonates. It's like later here's one that kind of gets something about what that looks like or something. I guess it's hard to talk about, because every time I say something, the opposite always is, there's always a contradiction or a paradox or something in there too. But a lot of the way I get it is by shuffling through those piles of stuff and trying to match up stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm inspired by all those things you mentioned. Sometimes it can push me further, push me a little bit off the edge of where I'm comfortable, which I like, you know. It can be confining to think, well, I need to have music that's going to fit with this. And I'd rather just sit around and write music. But because I'm forced into it, I pushed through some barrier that I hadn't been through before.
I love that. Yeah.
So I always feels like I learn something every time I do one of those things. Mm. Have you done much like film stuff or?
Nothing. No, I really haven't. And the closest thing is really this thing now that I'm working on, where the pictures really do directly relate to the music, because even the last thing that I made pictures, but I made music, and they're just a kind of in a loose.
All right, that was that. You have an album that's photos and songs and stuff.
Yeah, but this one, you know, so there's a person that I meet, and they have a story, and there's a place, and there's a story about that place, and so they're connected. But I feel like having the pictures, I think the thing that I find interesting is it seems to take me out of like a cognitive place. And I'm just sort of looking and sensing. And I just find that interesting. I would love to have the chance to work with film for probably the same reason. I love this silent, you know, you did the one with Bill Morrison of The Flood. And that's, I've also been reading, been reading the book by Barry, The Rising Tide.
Oh yeah, that sort of was became the framework for what the film was, in a loose way, but that's mind-blowing. I mean, talk about, it's like a insane kind of novel reading that, and it's all true.
It's all true, and it's just, it encapsulates the whole of society, you know, especially at that time. But when you read it, it's literally, there's so many parallels with like right here and right now. And, you know, that, because this, Jason, I don't know if you know this book about, it's called Rising Tide. It's by a guy named John Barry. And it's about the 1927 flooding of the Mississippi. And, but he also wrote, the same guy wrote a book about the 1918 influenza pandemic.
Okay.
He
seems to like lock on, he's an amazing guy, and he seems to lock on to these natural disasters or crises that bring out something, that say something much more about actual society, you know.
Wow.
By the responses, by the, you know, the response to the flood was terrible. It was awful, and black people were left literally high and dry. But not only them, because down in the parishes in Lower Louisiana below New Orleans, you know, the poor whites were hung out to dry too. It was just horrible. And so these books are talking about.
I just ordered them both.
And then Bill had made made that beautiful music with that film. Oh God!
And that was one of the trips. Actually, the way we did it, I had written again. I accumulated some stuff. We played at the Vanguard first and tried some of these just random tunes. But then we flew into Memphis. And it was, what year was it when we did this? But it was a huge flood. Like, we're coming into Memphis, and it was like we were at the, you know, so it was there was another major flood happening.
Yeah.
And so during that trip, we went to New Orleans, and then we came all up the river like we were, and doing some gig, you know, it was hard to get too many gigs. We played like in Oxford, Mississippi, and we played in New Orleans, and then we kept going on up, like played in Davenport, Iowa.
Sure.
We kind of worked our way up, just like the way the film does in St. Louis and stuff. But that was like, wow, to be there thinking about all that stuff. We were in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and the levee, we're standing on this levee and like 100 feet below us or whatever it is, there's the town is below us, and the water's like there, and you just, whoa, wait a second.
It's insane. Yeah.
This thing, and that's what, you know, talk about what they were doing sometimes, like just the horrific shit that was going on.
Yeah.
And it still goes on now, you know, poor people live over here and the rich, well, we need to let this water out.
Yep.
You know which side they're going to let it out on.
That's right. That is right.
And it's still happening now.
Mm-hmm.
In every kind of way. We don't need to get into all that.
Exactly.
But that was an amazing, the experience of doing that film with that music in particular was really.
I thought it captured the kind of the narrative of the buildup of the energy so beautifully. I saw you guys do it at Royce Hall, and that was great because the projection was large, you know, and that's such a great venue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then to see it actually, not just on a little screen, you know, to see it in a theater.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then also the way he structured the film, it's not, I mean, it's a horrific thing that happened, but it's about this resilience and coming up out of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like the way the thing ends with folks dancing. And you know, it's basically how rock and roll started, or something, you know, like people being sort of forced out and moving up north, and there's a lot more noise up there, so they got to get an electric guitar, and then bam, bam. I don't know.
I asked my dad about the flood. He would have been 9 years old, I think I figured it out. I mean, where he was in Shelby, which is north of Greenville, and it's further inland. The flood didn't really come to Shelby and that little sector that he was in.
Wow, but he must have been right amongst.
For sure. But there was a period of time when his mother and his brother and sister and he moved to a town called Laurel, which is in the east of the state, further south. For 1 year. And so I've done this genealogy research and looked at censuses. And the year that they were in Laurel is 1927 to 1928. So I think what happened is they got out of there and then they came back when everything was okay. And that's why his memory is so, he was like, we knew about it, but.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's further up river and things held a little bit better and didn't come as far.
But when you see the map of what happened, it's like the whole middle of the country was just
devastated,
washed out.
And like and water for 25, 50 miles on either side, you know, like just out into the, you can't even imagine it. It's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then there was that part of that film also that was really interesting. We may be going on so long about this film, but it's so great. There's a little section about the Sears Roebuck catalog.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's my dad would talk about. That's where he got his first trumpet was from the Sears Roebuck.
Yeah, catalog. Yeah.
So like when that part of the film came on, I was like. Like, yes, it's so real. You know, people could get their house from the Sears Roebuck.
Yeah, my grandparents got their house from, but the house was a Sears house.
Amazing. So much to think about. You've been playing every day as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's been, I found pretty quick into it. That's what's been kind of amazing. It's like I'll play a tune. Like normally for a long time I wanted to have time to just play, so here we go, I got the time. But I have found myself just playing, and that's what saved me. It always, my whole life, it saved me. But realizing that I really do love playing the guitar, but it's been amazing. Like I'll take a song, whatever comes, I don't have to do anything. So just whatever comes into my mind, I'll go for something and then I'll just end up maybe play the same song all day and find stuff. And that hasn't happened since I was, 40 years ago or something.
So, well, it's good. Yeah.
So that's been good. Just the kind of basic where there's no, I don't have any real deadline, or I don't have to have anything done for any particular purpose, really. It's disturbing looking at my calendar. Again, my calendar is, it's an old, you know, I don't use the phone for my, and I keep going like, wow, I don't even know what month it is. And then I look in it like today, I'll tell you where I was supposed to be. Today I should be in, somewhere between Vancouver and somewhere. I mean, every time I look at my calendar, it's like, man.
I know.
I used to complain about the leg room on the airplane or whatever. Now, I'll take it.
Yeah, I guess if you spend so... somebody asked me the other day, like, if I was missing being on the road. And I said, well, this has done something for me, which has helped me to not identify so much with being on the road, like, because which I've liked. I've just liked this sense of like, oh, I'm kind of home and I'm me and I'm just being me, whatever that is. It's a little bit, sometimes a little frustrating because there's nothing else to bounce it off of. Like, not many experiences that I can bounce it off of, but like the simplicity of it has somehow I've found refreshing or something valuable to look at.
Yeah, there's definitely some good in this too. And then there's sort of the days, I'm not used to having this pattern, and it seemed like every day, you know, we're babysitting my daughter's dog, you know, so it's like, you know, get up, take the dog out, come back, play, take the dog out. Like every day, sort of this.
So she didn't bring her dog to New Mexico?
No, but she's actually coming. She's on her way to that was the other thing. We were supposed to go out there.
Ah.
Like she got there a little while before all this started, and then everything changed.
So she had to just stay, yeah.
But right now she's on her way driving back here, and then she's going to get the dog.
Oh, good.
But I have to say, it's been nice having the dog.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard to be without the dog.
Yeah. The dog and the, well, no, my wife would understand these, but my guitar and the dog has definitely helped get us through this. And my wife.
Absolutely. I followed Monica's photography during this period, and I got her newspaper
Oh, that's so cool.
Super cool. I loved the form of it, this kind of dispatch, you know. super cool, sort of interior and exterior at the same time. And
yeah, she's really loving it out there.
It's beautiful.
Yeah,
sometimes I think I live in New Mexico. I love the place.
Yeah, I grew up in, I mean, Denver. It's a city, right? But still this little bit of a connection there for sure.
Yeah,
I think this is the most time we've ever got to spend together.
Totally.
So we keep sort of crossing paths really quickly all the time.
Yeah.
I guess we sort of played one song together once.
Just once at Stanford, if I'm...
Yeah.
Yeah, with Julian. Did we play a duo and then play something with Julian as well?
Something like that.
Yeah.
But maybe one day we'll actually be able to be in the same room together.
Cool. That'd be nice.
Let's please. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Love that so much.
All right, guys, think of a song.
Okay.
We'll make it happen one way or another, even if it's just two tin cups and some string stretched across the country. Instamatic cameras flipping really fast.
Old school.
Thanks for...
Yeah, thank you so much. Really good to see you guys.
Good seeing you. All right.
Okay.
How about it? Bye.
Okay, bye. Bye.